It was when you came on your official visit, they played like the old school movie with the Four Horsemen and the old school Notre Dame, and you got the, and there's a...
Now that's a follow-up question, Eric Hansen. That's a heck of a follow-up question right there.
If you can be physical and if you can take the breath out of somebody by hitting them, man, it don't matter how many yards or what the offense is or what the schemes are, that'll always be the same.
But I still think there's a place for Notre Dame and the ideals of Notre Dame football in the wide, broad scope of the sport right now.
Eric, I'm hoping I don't run into you in South Bend because it'll probably cost me a round of drinks.
From the South Bend Tribune and ND Insider, this is the Pot of Gold Podcast with Tyler James and Eric Hansen.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Pot of Gold, an ND Insider podcast. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined once again by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together we cover Notre Dame football for ND Insider and the South Bend Tribune. The Pot of Gold podcast is brought to you by Zaxby's, taking chicken to a whole new level of flavor. Stop by your neighborhood Zaxby's today or order at Zaxby's.com. And Tire Rack, the way tire buying should be. Notre Dame couldn't pull off the upset at number 3 Georgia and has little time to feel sorry about itself with number 18 Virginia coming to town this week. The Irish were one big play short of quieting the doubters in the 23-17 loss to the Bulldogs. For this week's podcast, we decided to bring on someone who's plenty familiar with big plays himself, and that's former Notre Dame All-American and Heisman Trophy runner-up Rocket Ishmael. Rocket, thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
First off, what did you think of Notre Dame's performance against Georgia and hanging tough with the Bulldogs?
Okay, so you got to realize, my family and I were driving back from my oldest son, who is in his senior year at Wyoming. He's a receiver, and they were playing in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So we were driving back to Dallas, listening to the game on the radio. And that's a little of a, you know, you got to have a good imagination, listening to it on a Georgia Bulldogs fan radio station. So it's like I'm listening to it from their perspective. And so it's like I'm having to balance them trying to, like, bring all kinds of voodoo hexes on our attempts to do well. And it's like, oh, man, it was kind of frustrating. But, you know, it seemed like that, you know, we held our own. I think that just listening to the announcers and everything on the radio, it seemed like we needed any opportunity that we had to take advantage of it. And we couldn't not capitalize on an opportunity just because it seemed like, from listening to the radio, and, you know, that if we didn't capitalize on it, it would take a big effort to make up for what we didn't capitalize on. And so, you know, it was a valiant effort. I listened to Coach Kelly's interview after the game, and he seemed like he was proud of the toughness. He was proud of the fight. He was proud of the grit. And he used that game to know, you know, what we have as far as just moving forward. And then it seemed like he still feels like we have a chance at the playoffs, depending on how we move from here. So, you know, that was my assessment of the game.
Rocket, before I ask you about a little bit more about the game and the state of the program, I do want to circle back and find out how your son is doing at Wyoming.
Oh, yeah, they're doing well. They started off, let's see, they're 3-1 now. They had a fast start in this last game in up in Tulsa, and then they kind of couldn't really find a rhythm on offense. Then the coach put in another quarterback, and they got a little spark. My son had a couple of big catches on the drives. They scored. They put their other quarterback in, and then they started getting momentum again. And with about 50 seconds left in the game, I think they were down by four. They got the ball to, like, maybe the 4-yard line, and then they ended up fumbling, and Tulsa recovered, and that was the game. But overall, man, he's doing well. He's with a good program, good coaches, I'm really happy for him.
Does he have a nickname?
We call him Rocket. We've been calling him Rocket since the day he was born. So,
okay.
That's just par for the course over here.
Okay. Back to Notre Dame. I did a piece last January with Tim Brown, and apparently you guys were sitting together at the Clemson game, and I think it struck both of you that, and Brian Kelly too after the game, that Notre Dame needed to have more elite speed at wide receiver and running back. Do you still kind of see that as the areas where maybe Notre Dame is not quite up to the level of some of the teams that are in the top five?
Well, two things. The first thing, the game for us turned when, I forget the gentleman's name. It was a young man. It was a starting DB. He got injured.
Julian Love.
And it's like, as soon as he got injured, they went right for the juggler. Hmm. And like most teams do, you capitalize on the other team's perceived or in reality to go over their weakness. And so when he went out the game, man, that's when they struck. And I feel like, just like I felt like when I was listening to the Georgia game, the talent level, everybody's healthy. Your first 11 guys are on the field, whether it's offense or defense. The coordinators, I'm thankful for them. I feel like they're more than competent. But it's like, if something happens to one of the starters, I don't feel we have the depth. Not that we don't have, like, our frontline guys. I feel like they can compete with anybody. They still have to capitalize, though. I don't feel like they're on an elite level, but it's like when people used to talk about how fast certain football players were, some of them would say, oh, they're world-class speed. But I know that there's world-class speed, and then there's elite world-class speed. And I feel like with that, we have the world-class athlete, but across the board, and it's not something that's easy now. That's not big. Elite world-class athletes don't just, every high school doesn't have them, and they're not just coming out the woodwork. But it seems like Clemson's, Alabama's, when USC was rolling back in the day, when Oregon was, it seemed like they would always have them at the right moment. And we have world-class athletes, but a lot of times it seems like the teams we're playing, especially when it gets to the level of the playoffs, it's like a world-class athlete against an elite world-class athlete. And then if one of our world-class athletes go down, then, man, it's put your finger in the dam or it's going to start flooding. And if the other team's elite world-class athletes goes down, man, it seems like they can just put another guy in there who's at the same level of play that the guy that went down was. So I just feel like that's the little difference between what we see consistently over the last couple of years and what we see with the top-tier teams in college football that are winning the national championships and getting into the playoffs year after year. Like, it's a foregone conclusion that's what's going to happen for them.
Rocket, one of the players that does have very good speed on Notre Dame's roster is Avery Davis, and he's a guy that has moved around a lot. He started at quarterback and moved to running back and receiver. Then they moved him over to defensive back, and now they've moved him back to a bit of a running back receiver role. I know, obviously, he has the speed, and certainly you did as a player, and you were able to sort of thrive in playing multiple different roles, whether it's a returner or a running back or a receiver. What does it take to be, and why were you able to be so versatile in adapting to those different roles?
Well, I think initially I was a running back, whether it was when I'm playing in a sandlot or when I got to Notre Dame. And then, I might have been 5'8", 166 my freshman year coming out of high school. And so when I stepped on campus, man, I looked like, you know, a doggone grasshopper to a human being as it compared me to the size of the other running backs. So I remember Coach Holtz said, you know what, as fast as you are, we're going to put you out on the – I was on the split inside. And then once they started putting the ball in my hands for kickoff returns, then it was like, okay, he can do something. So then he moved me to flanker, which then you incorporate in the offense we had anyway. You start incorporating the reverses. Mm-hmm. And then because we used to run some wishbone, and then we would run some, they actually would see me having success out of the wishbone. Then they'd put me in the eye as a tailback. And then, check this out. Then we played Miami, and it was hilarious because Coach Holtz and any team we played against, they'd make it seem like the other coach is the mortal enemy. But I remember after playing Miami one day, I think it was in South Bend, so we won. I don't know if it was the first, I think maybe it's the second Miami game. But anyhow, Coach Holtz comes to practice just jumping and skipping like a young adolescent with a big smile on his face. And he's like, Rocket, have I got a play for you? I just got off the phone with Jimmy Johnson, and this thing's going to work like a charm every time. And that's when he implemented the middle screen. Jimmy Johnson was like, hey, man, you need to get this guy. I wasn't a very good receiver as far as running routes and everything, or very polished, I should say. Mm-hmm. But figured out a way to get the ball in his hands as many times as not as possible. And then they implement the middle screen. So all of those, it's like, it was like a developing environment. But the thing that Coach Holtz liked was that I was fast. And one of the things that, because I was from Pennsylvania, being a running back, we prided ourselves on being tough as well. So for my size, I was also durable and tough. So Coach was like, okay, let's see if we can get the ball in his hands. I said all that to say, for the young man that has the foundation of speed, and they've moved him around to different places, but it's like we were just talking about. When it comes to playing against these elite teams that have a elite level, world-class athletes, then the thing that they mostly all have in common is speed. Like if you have speed, then you have the ingredients to work with. And now it's just a matter of being creative and figuring out how to get the ball in his hands and be able to help him be a spark or something that is a threat all the time, and let that be on the mind of the defense, and it's going to help open up your offense for you.
Rocket, if I'm not mistaken, you're in Texas these days, and the young man that Tyler was talking about, Avery Davis, played at Cedar Hill, so that's a pretty good program down there.
Oh, man, that's big. Let me tell you something. I live right in Dallas, and Cedar Hill is south of me. That's a big-time program. When I got to Dallas, there was a team, Southlake High School, big-time program. And, like, when I say big-time program, I remember when I came out of Notre Dame, I played in the CFL for 2 years, and I'm not exaggerating, but like a school like Cedar Hill, Southlake, they're just all over the state of Texas, Allen, Texas, where Kyler Murray is from, which is north of me. They have stadiums, like 30,000-seat stadiums, and they are filled to capacity on Friday nights. It's like, it's a big deal. And so any guys who come out of Texas, man, if they're prospering, and Cedar Hill is the highest level of, as far as size of college, like they have as many guys on their teams as any college program in the country. And yeah, that says a lot to him. I've not seen him play, or I'm sure I'll get a chance to when I actually get a chance to see a game on television. But yeah, man, that says a lot for the young man.
You're listening to the Pot of Gold podcast presented by Zaxby's. Before we hear more from Rocket Ishmael, let's take a short break.
We know you like football, So do we. We're TireRack.com, and this is our version of a two-minute drill, except it's only 30 seconds. TireRack.com has an enormous selection of tires. Not sure which ones to buy? Use our tire decision guide to find the right tires for your vehicle and the way you drive. Then get them shipped fast and free on all orders over $50. Shipping is in as little as one day. Free. TireRack.com ships to independent, recommended installers. TireRack.com, the way tire buying should be. Touchdown!
Rocket, I'm curious. We've talked about how you impacted the game in many ways during your career. What are your thoughts on how sort of the kick return game has sort of been limited with you can't even do two-player wedges anymore. Teams are more likely to take touchbacks. You can get it on the 25. What are your thoughts on that sort of being taken out of the game more or less as a safety precaution?
Well, yeah, to your last couple of words, my thought is anything that will give a greater level of protection to players, man, I'm all for it. I'm thankful that when I played, you know, it was still intact because that was one of the ways that I could get involved in the game, especially early on as a freshman. But yeah, anything that has anything to do with just protecting players and making the game as safe as possible, I'm all for it.
Rocket, what are your impressions of Brian Kelly? How well do you know him? What do you think he's doing with the program?
So I know him, like when I see him, say, hey, I know him good enough. If something's going on, like recently he sent me a text of congratulations for something, I forget what it was, but when I see him at the Super Bowl functions and get-togethers, it's all awesome. And I tell you, to me, the thing that I like about, especially guys who are in positions of authority, is their ability to be flexible and to be honest with themselves and make changes. And it's like, I feel like his evolution as a man who understands he's in a position that is very important in the landscape of college football, and not just being content with, you know, whatever his resume was and coming in and, hey, this is my style, take it or leave it, but always looking to evolve, always looking to improve, and taking actual steps to do that, man, my hat's off to him. And the most important thing, the response that you get from your players. So when I'm talking to players from, you know, whether it's my godson who was there when he transitioned after the Charlie Weiss years, or even young guys who played for him as recent as 2 years ago, man, all of them can confirm the same. So, you know, that's how I measure him. And so that, and I feel like the program is in good hands, especially with the combination of him and Jack. So I really feel like anything that has to do anything outside of that, you know, I don't have any clue outside of that.
Rocket, speaking of congratulations on being inducted in the College Football Hall of Fame this year. And I'm curious, I'm sure you run into lots of Notre Dame fans throughout many different things, and probably will with all the College Football Hall of Fame stuff. What is the specific play that fans bring up to you the most when they're talking about your career?
This is hilarious. Monday? Isn't that Monday or Tuesday?
Today is Tuesday.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
No, you're good.
On Sunday, I was at a function here in Cowboy Stadium, and a guy comes in. He's like, and I'm, you know, taking pictures with people and just, you know, just meeting and greeting and stuff like that. And one guy is like, oh, my God. And it was almost like he had it wasn't a scowl. It wasn't Glee. It was somewhere in the middle, and he was just like, oh my gosh, I remember when you came to the Big House in 1989. That was my first college football game. I was rooting for the Mighty Wolverines. And you ruined my day. You absolutely ruined it. And it was like he just was going on and on. And then I had to like stop him and interject respectfully. And so, you know, it can be that game with the, I think they were number two. And we came into the season at number one. Or maybe they came into the season at number two. Maybe we came in at number three. Whatever it was. But the Michigan game and the last game, the national championship against Colorado, the last punt. So it's either, it's like a throw up between those two, and whenever a fan will come up and start reminiscing.
Rocket, I know education's important to you. You went back and got your degree after coming out as a junior. I know this past spring, Troy Nicholas, Josh Adams, and Jalen Smith came back, and Jalen actually got his degree. I'm wondering if you could talk to us just briefly about what brought you back to get your degree, and also this Extra Yard for Teachers initiative. I know Mr. Forsini was a teacher in your past that meant a lot to you. If you could talk about those two things in regard to your education, your love for it.
Okay, so as far as Notre Dame is concerned, my goal is for when I was a young man and wanted to go to Notre Dame and actually it becoming a reality and finding out that I could actually go there, it was football and academics that's on the same level. And so all of a sudden football, my dream about being a pro football player was coming to pass, and it turned out that I was able to go and fulfill that dream. And at the same time, and it's interesting because you mentioned Mr. Forsini. He's a guidance counselor at my high school, Wilkes-Barre Myers High School. And Sister Kathleen, she was an academic advisor at Notre Dame. And so she was my academic advisor. And it was hilarious because I remember the season started in July. So I get to Canada, in Toronto, Canada, move into my apartment, and July, August, maybe around September, you know, I get a call, and not many people have my phone number, so I was like, who is this? He's like, the phone is ringing, I pick it up, and on the other end, I hear a voice, and she's like, Rocket? I was like, Sister? She's like, hey, it's Sister Kathleen. And she said, I was like, hey, Sister, how you doing? And so I knew that if she called, she must have got my number from my mom. And she said, I was like, well, are you in town? Are you coming to a game or something? She's like, oh, no. She said, it's time to make your... She said, it's time to make your class schedule for the spring semester. I'm like, my class schedule for the spring. So what are you talking about? Yeah, it said, you have, however it broke down, I would be able to take X amount of credits for the next three semesters and then I'd be able to graduate. And so she had it all laid, and I was on the phone. I was like, and she's like, we promised your mother you'd graduate. And I was like, okay, well, yeah. And so it was like Sister Kathleen was the impetus behind and keeping the promise to my mother. And, she made sure that every time at a certain time during the season, my first 2 years when I was in Canada, we get my class schedules together, and then my last year when I was coming to play with in the NFL, did the same thing, and I ended up graduating April 1994, and it was one of the, and I'm so thankful that I did. Because it's one of the proudest moments of my life, and my mom and my grandmother were there, and I have a picture of them that said the same, and that was awesome. And it's really important to have people in your life along the way, especially when you're young, to help guide you and to help let you see beyond the moment. Because in the moment, a lot of times you don't realize the importance of current decisions and how they will weigh against, you know, your future. And in the same capacity, when I was in high school, I remember my dad died. My grandmother was 77 years old. My brothers and I, my mom, my three brothers, my mom had to work, and she was gone all day, and you know, my dad is gone. So now with the discipline and staying in front of the house, it was kind of out the window. And anyway, my grandmother stepped in and said, "Hey, send the boys with me." Again, she was 77 years old, which still blows my mind to this day. And sent us to Myers High School right there in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And in seventh grade, did okay, but wasn't really focused, wasn't really on point as far as study habits and things of that nature. And I just remember at the end of the second semester, maybe, I forget specifically, but my brother and I were called to the guidance counselor's office. Now, you know, I'd never heard of somebody getting called to the guidance counselor. We might get called to the principal, but, you know, the guidance counselor, what the heck kind of new world is this? And we get to the guidance counselor's office, and there is Mr. Frassini. And, man, he had these big, thick glasses that looked like the glasses Mr. Magoo wore. And, I mean, he had a full head of hair. It was all white. His skin was even whiter than his hair. And he was sitting there, and he said, "Ah, gentlemen," and I'm paraphrasing basically, but he was essentially said, "Hey, you know, I'm looking at your grades here, and this isn't acceptable." He was just so matter of fact. And it was crazy because he wasn't mad, or it wasn't belittling, but it was like he cared about us. And not only did he tell us it wasn't acceptable, but then he had a game plan on how we were going to not ever have to come to his office for grade problems or issues again. And he went and got two of the stellar upperclassmen at the time, which was the Lott brothers, Greg and Paul Lott. And Greg ended up playing football at Penn State, and Paul Lott went to Harvard. And he got them to essentially make sure we were being held accountable and that we were doing our work. And it was just, you know, I just thought, okay, this is how they do it here in Wilkes-Barre. And I didn't think anything of it, but that laid the groundwork to be able to have a good foundation academically where I would even have a chance to go to Notre Dame, and where my brother would even have a chance to go to Syracuse. And, you know, for that, and again, no way were we stars or in any way would somebody look at us at that point of our life and say, "Man, this is my brother. That's going to be, they're going to be a force in football and Northeastern Pennsylvania as far as high school is concerned." Like, none of that was going to, would be apparent at all if you saw. As a matter of fact, you'd be like, "Poor guys, they'll never be able to play football because they are so puny." So it's like the fact that he took the time to do that, you know, love him to this day. And anytime you get a chance to celebrate people who have had a significant part in your life, even if you didn't know that what they were doing at the time was significant, I'm down for it.
Rocket, last one before we let you get out of here. What you mentioned you're busy with your son, and you're down in Dallas watching your son play football, and you're down in Dallas. What else keeps you busy these days?
Oh, wow. So it's football season right now. So, oh, man, speaking engagements, appearances, and that's usually during the season. And now, for the last 4 years, I've been working with the NFL Legends community, which was started by Troy Vincent when he came up to the NFL, and it essentially celebrates, reconnects and educates former players after they retire from the game to help transition into the civilian life, if you will. And so that's a year-round deal. And the most important thing that I'm doing is, man, learning how to be a good husband and a better husband every day, and learning how to be a better father every day as well.
All right, Rocket. Well, we appreciate you taking time to talk to us today, and wish you the best of luck moving forward. You're listening to the Pot of Gold podcast presented by Zaxby's. Now it's time for Place Your Bets.
How much you want to make a bet I can throw a football over the mountains?
This is our segment dedicated to the degenerates. Let's take our shot at some prop bets for the Virginia game. First one I have for us, Eric, is over under 2.5 sacks allowed by Notre Dame against Virginia.
Well, Virginia leads the country. They're actually tied with Florida at 5.0 per game. They get a lot of pressure from their linebacker. So this is the fourth 34 look that Notre Dame has seen, and probably the fourth different way it's expressed. I'll tell you, Notre Dame showed me something in the Georgia game where there were 47 pass attempts, no sacks, and no semblance of a running game. So I'm going to go under.
Yeah, it was interesting. The more I watched Georgia film after the game, their defense more reminded me of what Notre Dame's doing with their 4-2-5 scheme than a 3-4 defense. So it's just kind of interesting how they've played, in theory, 3-4 defenses to start the season, but they're also very different. But I'm going to go with under. I think Book has done a good job of avoiding sacks. He seems to be getting more comfortable, although people seem to want to get on him anytime he leaves the pocket, which I think sometimes is deserved, sometimes he needs to do that, and sometimes he should stay in the pocket. But for all the troubles that Notre Dame's offensive line has had running with clearing lanes for the running game, I think they've done a pretty good job overall against the pass rush. And as long as they can identify where the different linebackers from Virginia can be coming from, I feel like they'll have a good chance of keeping that number of under 2.5 sacks for Virginia. Next one I have for us is over under 50 rushing yards for Virginia quarterback Bryce Perkins.
Well, you know, Bryce is an interesting quarterback. Chip Long, when he was Arizona State, actually helped recruit him to Arizona State. And then he went through junior college and ended up at Virginia. And in a couple of seasons, or a season and less than a half, he's climbing the Virginia career rushing leader. So this is a very good running quarterback. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go over with Perkins. I think between scrambles and planned runs, that's where a lot of Virginia's rushing yards are going to come from.
Yeah, I'm going over as well. I think he's going to put Notre Dame's linebackers and safeties in some tough positions, and they can't necessarily overcommit to him as a runner too, because he is a talented passer. So he's averaging 48.25 yards per game, and I think he'll be able to surpass that mark against Notre Dame. Next one I have is over under 200 passing yards for Bryce Perkins.
You know, Notre Dame went into the Georgia game third in the country in pass efficiency defense. They're still in the top 10. And they survived Jake Fromm. I think Virginia's going to be a little bit under 200 passing. Not by much, but I think maybe 180s.
Yeah, I'm going under as well. I think Notre Dame's defense, I think part of the reason they've been so high is they've had a lot of interceptions early in the season, and they also have done a good job of limiting big plays and touchdowns against them. So I think that will allow them to keep Virginia and Bryce Perkins under 200 passing yards. Next one is over under 110 rushing yards for Notre Dame. People gave me a lot of crap for putting it at 120 last week against Georgia. So I lowered it down to 110, and I'm sure people will probably think it's still high, still too high. What do you think?
Strangely, I think they're going to get over, but not by much, maybe 111. I think that Notre Dame is going to commit more to the run. 14 carries tied a Kelly era low, and I just think they can't go with the same game plan for 2 weeks in a row. I also think with as much as Virginia blitzes, they're going to get caught in a draw play that's going to get some yardage. Mm-hmm. And I think Book's going to be involved more in the rushing game. So I will say just a hair over 110.
Yeah, I want to go over too, but I'm going to stick with under and just make Notre Dame's running game kind of prove it until they do. I think probably some of their big technically or not really running plays will be maybe some of those sweeps again, and there's just I think they're fine with those being a part of the running game, but just in the box score, it's not going to count as runs. So because of that reason, those are probably some of their biggest chances to get big gains. I'll go under 110 rushing yards. Next one is over under 5 penalties against Notre Dame. Coming off of 12 against Georgia.
Right. I'm doing the math in my head.
I know. I'm letting you think. I'm filibustering.
Notre Dame averaged 5.5 during their first two games. And during the Brian Kelly era, they've been between 5 and 6 most years. So I'll go slightly over. I'll say they'll have 6.
Yeah, I'll go over as well. I don't think there'll be as many false start penalties, but I do think here and there. It was kind of surprising how many different penalties they had in special teams, even some that didn't necessarily count. But I think they got some things to clean up, and I think coming off such a tough game and maybe not being in the best physical condition after that may lead to some brain farts and some mistakes when it comes to the penalties. So I'll go over 5 penalties. Last one, which we forgot to do last week, is a final score prediction for Notre Dame, Virginia.
Well, I would have picked 23-17 Georgia, but I'm going to say 25-17 Notre Dame, and the sad Irish fan from 4 years ago will not be in the stadium. I talked to him this week, Mike Bunting, so he will have to be either have a moral victory or sad in Austin, Texas, where he lives now.
All right. I will go 31-24 Notre Dame. That's actually what I had in the preseason magazine, and I'll stick with it. I'm a little concerned if Notre Dame can get to 30 points against Virginia's defense with how Virginia's defense is playing, but also Virginia hasn't been playing against the greatest offenses either, so I'm kind of curious to see how that all pans out. But I still think Notre Dame will be able to win, maybe not cover the spread, but it's not going to be an easy victory this weekend. All right, now it's time for punctuation mark of the week.
Mrs. Judy Mitchelson Hicks, sometimes with a hyphen, sometimes without a hyphen. Sometimes she spells the hyphen.
This is our weekly segment to recognize the apostrophes, periods, and hyphens on Notre Dame's roster. And even though he's already won it once this season, we're going to give it again to linebacker Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah. He had a great game with 8 tackles, which was tied for the team high, and also had 2.5 tackles for a loss, and responded really well, I thought, to sort of a disappointing game against New Mexico where he had more mistakes than he probably would have liked. What, in your opinion, has been the most impressive aspect of Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah's game so far?
I think it's been his ability to take on so many different skills, that he can rush the passer, that he can cover, that he plays the run well. I think it's his versatility over one particular thing. How about you?
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. I think I have been surprised with his ability, just as a hitter, a physical tackler. I thought, and he does that a lot on special teams even, and I knew he was very fast and an agile guy and was going to be able to maybe cover some guys and cover space well, but I wasn't really for sure what that was going to look like in a game sense of how hard of a hitter he would be and how sure of a tackler he would be. And he's really done a good job of that overall, I think, so far in these first 3 games. All right, next one is time for our junior or junior.
It's junior.
My junior.
Our junior now.
Our junior. Our junior.
This is our weekly segment to highlight one junior by name or one junior by grade. And the easy pick this week was junior tight end Cole Kmet. He had 9 catches for 108 yards and 1 touchdown in his return from the broken collarbone. He also, unfortunately, had 3 false start penalties and not a great day blocking necessarily. But how do you think this Notre Dame offense will look differently now that Cole Kmet is a guy that they can sort of rely on and has proven to be a threat against a top defense like Georgia?
Well, I think it's certainly going to be more dynamic, and it puts defensive coordinators in a bigger predicament because they have to account for him, and it'll, I think, open up opportunities either in the wide receiving core or in the running game, depending on how teams want to defense him. But I mean, he's an NFL caliber tight end, and it also gives Chip Long another toy in terms of formations,
right?
With
they can line him up all over the place, and some of Book's deepest completions were just to Cole Kmet stretching the field down the seam, and you don't necessarily think of a tight end as someone that's going to help stretch out the defense for you, but I think he is able to do that. Ian looks definitely very confident in throwing to him, and Cole is willing to catch those balls, even though he knows he might get decked by a safety pretty soon after catching one of those passes. So I'm interested to see how he does. I'd like to see him do better as a blocker. I think he'd be good as a blocker in some screens, which Notre Dame has had some trouble getting the screen game really established, at least from the wide receiver's perspective. Maybe he could help out with that as well. All right, now it's time for questions.
Just tell me when you guys – are we done with USC? Everybody's done. You guys are kidding me. That's all you want to talk about. All right, let's go.
You can submit questions to us on Twitter each week. I'm at TJamesNDI, and Eric is at EHansonNDI. First one we have, Eric, is from Samuel Ramirez at Samuel27RC. After the solid game from Asmar Bilal and Drew White, do you think there will be less rotation in the linebackers?
I actually asked Brian Kelly about that on Sunday, and I do think he kind of hinted. Now, Georgia was only able to run 59 plays,
right.
So in a 77 or 80-play game, I think you'll still see some, but I think they've settled on their two guys, and it makes sense to go with them as long as they can physically stand it in games at this point.
Right, yeah, I agree. And I think this week is going to be a real test for them because I think they were physically tested against Georgia, and certainly the number that they didn't have a high play count necessarily, although they were out there for most of the plays. I think that was a very physically demanding game, and how they rebound this week will be interesting. So I think you maybe want to keep those guys in a rotation this week as long as you still trust those other players. But I think Notre Dame is probably going to be moving forward with those guys as the answers, as long as they can handle it, because there aren't a lot of guys behind them you feel totally confident in. And I think confidence in Asmar Bilal and Drew White has to be at an all-time high right now. Next question is from at Dick Barone, CEO. I saw Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah trying to play through an injury and limping as the ball was going to be snapped. Alohi Gilman used good leadership, having him go down to get medical attention and not hurt worse. I was very aggravated. Gary Danielson was adamant Endy was faking injuries. Did you see the same thing?
Well, I don't know that Gary Danielson was adamant that they were faking injuries. I think he first mentioned that Georgia fans thought they were, and then he kind of chimed in, but raising the possibility of, I'm not sure.
Right, yeah, they showed the replay, and he said this is what they're doing. It seems like they're maybe trying to slow Georgia down because it wasn't clear the play before that Jeremiah was necessarily hurt. But I think that the play before that, Jeremiah made a tackle, and he got up a little awkwardly and went on to play the next play, and then was still walking a little bit strangely, and I think Alohi Gilman wisely recognized that he was having some issues and just basically yanked him down because they knew he needed to get off the field. I know people have been questioning whether or not that was intentional, and Sean Crawford looked like he may have been ready to go to the ground if needed, but I think it's just being smart players, and I think they know that that's what you have to do to get off the field, because you can't count necessarily on the refs recognizing that you're having those issues. It would have been because Jeremiah was evaluated for a concussion, he went into the tent after coming off the field. You would have liked to see maybe the official spotter up top whistle in and say, "Hey, Jeremiah needs to get off the field," and that didn't happen immediately. And maybe because that didn't happen, it certainly drew the ire of Georgia fans. But Georgia fans were fired up no matter what was happening. I remember one of the incomplete passes that Jake Fromm threw into the end zone. From the first look, it looked like he may have caught it, but the guy clearly dropped the pass, and so it was called incomplete. And then they show the replay even on the jumbotron, and they all start booing because they thought he got his 2 feet in or got a foot in and caught it. It's like, no, the ball's over there. What are you guys yelling about? Yeah. So I think the crowd's reaction made it a bigger deal. And then when Asmar went out again later, they thought that maybe there was some shenanigans going on there, but to me, it seemed like it was clean. Asmar Bilal was clearly getting his eyes looked at. It's a little confusing that Brian Kelly has discussed him having a cramping issue when it seemed that it was something to do with his eye. But I think that this isn't that big of a deal. It's not like it's a long a thing that Notre Dame is doing regularly, and I don't know that it gave Notre Dame an advantage in those situations that they had to get those guys off the field. And we're talking about they don't have a deep linebacker group, and they need help. So I think it's being a little bit blown out of proportion. Next question is from Christian Bogan at C_Bogan1989. What are your thoughts on the offensive line? Pass protection looked great most of the game against Georgia, but I didn't see much push during running plays. Is that due to the offensive line's inability to get a good push or a lack of an explosive running back?
Well, first of all, there were 9 running plays for a running back. So yeah, it's pretty small sample size, however you want to conclude it. I certainly think this offensive line has room for improvement, but I think Notre Dame's problems in the running game are injuries and bad running back recruiting. And I think that the guys that are on the roster are doing a great job of developing, but there's not the elite speed. And Notre Dame certainly has that in the next recruiting class. But I think the knee-jerk reaction is to blame the offensive line, and I think that's misplaced.
Yeah, I think there's blame to go all around. And certainly when you only have a limited amount of rushing attempts, it's hard to get in a rhythm and feel like you're on the same page with the running back, and also understanding what the defense is trying to do against you when you're trying to run the ball. So I think it's tough to get in a groove when your rushing attempts are limited. Certainly Notre Dame's offensive line isn't necessarily making big enough holes for someone like Tony Jones Jr. to take advantage of. And perhaps maybe the spaces that are available, someone quicker could get them through there faster and it wouldn't make a difference. But they're not getting a great push, and from a lot of times I feel like I keep saying this, the tight ends aren't doing a great job of blocking. Even Cole Kmet didn't have a great day, and those guys are crashing down inside, and because there's not a hole for Tony Jones or someone else to run through right away, they're hesitating a little bit, and then someone from the outside is coming in and making the play. And so it all kind of builds on itself. I certainly think there's plenty of room for improvement, it's just they weren't going to show that they were going to be great running the ball against Georgia, so I thought the game plan made sense to me. Their chance to win was going to have to put it on Ian Book's shoulders and see what he could do, take the short throws when necessary. We'll see if they can do better this week moving forward. I would imagine they will be better moving forward as more running backs get healthy, even with Jameer Smith back if he can get in the game, which Brian Kelly termed him as probable. So I think it's not going to be a great season for the team running the football, but they're going to have to figure out some sort of solution better than what they did against Georgia. Next question is from Mike at KYNDFan. What can be done this season to create a more explosive running game?
I would say get a witch doctor that could get Jafar Armstrong back sooner than USC week.
That would help.
I think also what will help is once Notre Dame gets through Virginia, they face 4 rush defenses that are rated 88th or lower.
Yeah, everyone's going to look explosive against Brian Van Gorder's defense.
Yeah, so I think those two things help. But I think, you know, I think moving Avery Davis was a risk worth taking, mm-hmm. because he is a very quick athlete. It's just, can he translate it into actual production? We're going to find out the next couple weeks. And then it's got to be addressed through recruiting, and that's what they're doing right now. And that's, I think, the best that you can hope for. I think you got to be inventive with jet sweeps and, you know, the screen game has got to be kind of your running game,
right,
too. So I think they've got to be inventive schematically, but ultimately recruiting is the way you're going to address this.
Yeah, to me, that the jet sweeps, the fly sweeps, whatever you want to call them, even though they're sometimes being technically counted as passes, I think that is the answer. We saw what the answer was for Notre Dame. They felt like that was their best solution to that. We even saw early in the game they were doing sweeps and reverses to Lawrence Keys and giving him a chance to do that, which is something I thought they would do, and they hadn't used too much with him specifically until the Georgia game. So I think that's probably going to be the answer. There's not a simple solution. I think Jameer Smith could be a little bit more explosive. I don't know that he's going to rip off 70-yard touchdown runs. I don't know that anyone besides Jafar Armstrong has the capability to do that on Notre Dame's roster. At least on a running play up the middle. So what they have is what they have, and they're going to have to try and get by with it. Next question is from Frank Sarah at Frank Sarah 3, another running game question. The first three games, ND opponents have used run blitzes to stop ND rushing, the ND rushing game. How can Notre Dame combat this?
I haven't studied the film as much as Tyler has with that, so I don't know how often they've done it.
You're not sending any suggestions to Chip Long?
Yeah. So, I mean, usually, again, any kind of blitzing, it starts with the quarterback recognizing it and then changing the play at the line of scrimmage. So if they're run blitzing, if they're pass blitzing, it's really on Ian Book's shoulders to figure out a way to counteract that with the best possible play. And I feel like, you know, this deep into his starting career, he's starting to get good at that. And so I would expect that to be the solution. Maybe I'm oversimplifying.
No, I think that's right. And I think it's getting yourselves in the right play. Sometimes if the defense is going to send more defenders against the running game than you have blockers, your best answer is to throw the ball. And I think a guy like Cole Kmet is a perfect kind of guy that just get him in the middle of the field and throw the ball to him quickly, and that will force the defense to not blitz as much because they can't leave those openings there for him.
If you want to see an example of how to defeat a blitz, watch Jake Fromm play, because yes, he's really good at it.
Yeah, he recognizes it. He gets rid of the ball quickly, and he puts the ball. I'm not sure if he threw three passes that weren't catchable against Notre Dame. Even his incomplete passes, they were right there for the guys to catch. It just didn't come down with them. He was great. Gary Danielson didn't lead us astray with his analysis of Jake Fromm. Next question we have is from AM at NDIrish0824. Trying to figure out why Ian Book doesn't throw it deep more. Can he not see because of his height? Are they not confident in him? Is he not confident in himself? Or just not what Chip Long wants him to do? I used to think it was because he couldn't, but he has showed that he can.
Okay, there were multiple choices in there, and I love multiple choice.
Just go with C, right?
Questions. You know, one thing that Brian Kelly brought up Monday that I thought was interesting is that in these 34 looks, Book's sight lines are different than a 43 look. Mm-hmm. And so that may be a little bit of it. But I think a lot of it is what Chip Long wants to call in the game plan. Again, they're not trying to prove whether he has the arm to do it or not. They're trying to win the game. And I think they maybe should have done that a little bit more in the third quarter against Georgia. But they were hanging with Georgia, and they had a chance to win at the end. So they're going to do what they think is best to win the game. I think that once Michael Young and Braden Lindsey are back healthy, which is supposed to be this week,
right,
then you have personnel that are going to express those deep balls a little bit better as well.
Yeah, and I think against Georgia specifically, you didn't want to risk doing a play action, dropping back 12 yards and getting sacked, because that throws off the whole drive. And that was certainly some of the reason the penalties were such a big deal, because even losing 5 yards and putting yourself in a first and 15 was pretty detrimental to this offense against such a good defense. And so even when Ian Book did throw it deeper, he threw one to Lawrence Keys down the left side. He threw that pretty quickly, and Lawrence Keys got down the field in a hurry and was able to bring that down. I thought maybe that's a play that gives Ian more confidence in Lawrence Keys coming down with the ball in traffic. It wasn't like Lawrence Keys ran by the guy. He kind of threw a jump ball for him, and Lawrence Keys came down with it. So I think it's just more trust in those guys. I think Chase Claypool can't do everything, and I feel like at times he feels like he's leaning on him as having to do the short routes, the intermediate routes, the deep balls. And so they just need some other guys to do that with. I think one of the deep shots they wanted to take was on the flea flicker play, and it just didn't work. Georgia blitzed a cornerback at the perfect time and was in Ian Book's face before he could do anything with it, and rolled out and ended up throwing interception when he should have thrown it away. But it's just a lot of different things. I think Chip Long is still going to leave some of those shot plays in the offense, and I think Ian Book wants to take them. It's just you have to be smart with when you take them. And I just think against the Georgia defense, it felt like too much of a risk, especially while it was such a close game. You didn't want to give it away on trying to do something like that. Next question is from the Jackal at Freak of Nature. Speaking of that flea flicker, he said, flea flicker down 10, why? And why so little of Javon McKinley and Lawrence Keys?
Let me start with that part of the question first. I don't think they ignored Lawrence Keys at least being on the field, but Javon McKinley, I thought we would see more of him because I thought Notre Dame would commit to the run more.
Right.
He makes more sense if you're going to commit to the run. If you're not, different personnel like Keys and Fink being on the field and this week Michael Young make more sense. Javon can catch the ball, and he's a physical blocker at 6'2", 230. He's one or 220. He's one of their best run blockers. And I think we'll see more of him this week because I think the game plan is going to change a little bit. Notre Dame's going to have some more traditional running plays this week. Now, the first part of it was how come the flea flicker at that time? I think Notre Dame had to play left-handed at times in this game to have a chance to win. And I think, yeah, those plays always, when they don't work, it's like, why are they doing that? And when they do work, it's like, brilliant. And, again, that corner blitz was perfectly timed. I don't think they knew it was going to be a flea flicker. It just
happened. Out that way,
And had it worked, we would all be celebrating what a brilliant call that was by Chip.
Right, and we can't have people complaining about them not throwing the ball deep, and then they have a play which is specifically designed to get the ball deep, and because it doesn't work, they're like, well, why did you run that? It's like, well, because they need to throw the ball deep. I didn't like the design in that they were running it to the boundary, so there wasn't a lot of room. So even if Georgia would have not seen it coming, they could have reacted and got back in a position to stop the play. That would have been my only tweak on that. It was really bad luck. Maybe Ian Book could have seen that cornerback was coming and checked out of the play. But even then, I don't know that it was necessarily the wrong play call. It's just trying to figure out something. And certainly, maybe because Notre Dame didn't run the ball a lot, it's not like they were going to sell out to stop Tony Jones on that run. It certainly didn't fool Georgia, and that just goes to show that they're fundamentally sound and technically sound, and we're on top of things. But sometimes you call plays that don't work. I don't know. The problem was that Ian Book still tried to throw the ball, and that's Brian Kelly said after the game. You got to either be a hero on that play or take a zero, and Ian Book needed to take the zero and just throw the ball away rather than try to squeeze it into Chris Fink. Next question is from Toby Deal at TDISU19. What's up with Chris Fink? Isn't it about time to go all in with the other guys? I'd rather see somebody with more explosion and higher upside, a.k.a. Joe Wilkins and Lawrence Keys in the slot. If Fink can't make the contested catches or shake a linebacker, then why is he in there? He's not even a good blocker. A lot of anger from Toby Deal towards Chris Fink here.
When we watch practice both in the spring and in August, I thought Chris Fink was really difficult to defend both in one-on-one type drills and also in 11-on-11. He showed out in those drills that he was one of Notre Dame's top options.
Against a great passing efficiency defense, we're talking about at Notre Dame.
Right. I think what's hurt Chris is not having Michael Young and having to play on the outside some. Now, even on his routes from the slot against Georgia, I thought Chris would say that was maybe his worst game in the past couple of years.
Right, for sure.
So I think he had a bad day.
Yeah.
And I think he's had a really good career and had a lot of other really good games and a lot of other really good practices that would counteract wanting to make a switch in personnel.
Yeah, and I think he is a guy that's earned having a bad game. Certainly you don't want him to have a bad game, but he's made contested catches before. He did in that game even before some of the mistakes were – He dropped the pass that ended up being intercepted, which was even thrown behind him. Although Chris will tell you that he should have caught the football, that was a bad play for him. He even one of the contested catches he made, he sort of juggled it but pinned it against the other guy's back and came down with it.
Yeah.
You talk about the Michigan touchdown catch that he had last year, obviously the catch against USC. He's made plays for Notre Dame. They need him out there because you can count on him. Just because he lets you down in one game against Georgia doesn't mean you need to throw him out and replace him with guys that have done very little in their career. Certainly, there may be room to get those guys involved, and they have gotten Lawrence Keys involved in the game. But I don't know that it's worth taking a lot of playing time away from Chris Finke because you can't trust him. He might not be a great blocker, but I think he's a pretty good blocker, and he's a pretty willing blocker. If you watch him, he's not going to plow guys over. I don't know that anyone besides Chase Claypool is going to do that in terms of Notre Dame's wide receivers, but he's not afraid to get in the mix against defensive backs to help out his teammates. Next question is from Josh Melton at Joshua Melton. How much of a hangover do you see coming this week from the Irish? This Georgia loss is one that could easily linger. They are saying all the right things with Khalid Kareem and Brian Kelly as examples, but will it carry over to Saturday? Virginia is a dangerous opponent.
I guess a lot of times my answer to that is we'll know Saturday.
Yeah.
They are saying the right things, and I think doing the right things. When I asked Brian Kelly about it yesterday, he mentioned that there was going to be a players-only meeting before Brian Kelly had a chance to talk to them. I think they've got a pretty good leadership group, and I don't think they overlook Virginia. I think they know how good Virginia is, and they also know that beating Virginia may be the second best team on their schedule and lead to a nice postseason destination, whether it's New Year's Six or something just below it or just above it. This Virginia game is very important to them. So I'm going to say they won't have a hangover with it because I think they have good leadership on their team.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, like, sometimes I feel like we get into a routine of, if you played a tough game the game before and you lose the next one, it's because you are hungover from the last one. Virginia is a good enough team to beat Notre Dame no matter when they're playing them on their schedule. They could beat Notre Dame on Saturday with Notre Dame playing well and having it no ill effects from the Georgia game because Virginia does have talent. So I think it'll be interesting to see. I think I mentioned earlier, linebackers are guys that I want to see how they respond from playing last week. I think the offensive line, too, how they can recover, because I think Virginia's front is going to cause some issues as well. So I think those are the two positions I would keep an eye on the most to see how they bounce back physically. If they look like they're gassed or aren't playing as hard as you would expect them to. But I don't think it's necessarily going to be because of the hangover. I think it's just because of the execution and coming through. And I don't think Notre Dame has any question about how much this game means to them and means for this season. So I think they're going to come out ready to play. Next question is from Michael Johnston at NDMD. Who can help the coaching staff prepare the team for loud, raucous games where crowd noise will be a factor? It appears they need an outside consultant at this, as this is a recurring problem.
I don't think that the problem is recurring. I think if you're talking about the Miami game in 2017, they weren't prepared mentally.
Right.
I think in this game, the challenges were actual physical noise. And Notre Dame they have their new indoor facility where they can simulate that more. You know, Tyler, you can probably speak to this better than me. I'm not sure that you could have done a lot more in terms of, you know, dialing up the decibels. I think the one thing that is correctable is, you know, Ian Book resorting to the clap maybe a couple times rather than the way that they do silent counts, which you can explain.
Yeah, that was weird. First, I'll speak to how loud it was. I was down on the field for Notre Dame's last offensive series, and if you remember, before the very last offensive play for Notre Dame, the fourth down, Georgia ran onto the field and called a timeout. Kirby Smart called a timeout from the sideline. I could not hear the ref on the other side of the field whistling to stop the play. I just saw him running in, waving his hands. That's how loud it was, and I was on ground level. I was by the marker, so I was by the referee on Notre Dame's side of the field. It was very loud, and certainly, you have to take Notre Dame's word for it that they were able to mimic that decibel level in their indoor facility. I wasn't there. I don't know, and I don't have a decibel level measurer to prove that or not. But the way that Notre Dame used its silent counts or clapping cadence was a little confusing to me. And clearly they thought they could do the clapping at certain points and then decided to go away from that. And when they went to the silent count, and I'll explain this because I'm not sure how well everyone understands it. It's usually, in this instance, it was Aaron Banks would look back at Ian Book, and Ian Book raises his leg to let him know that he's ready. Aaron looks back forward, taps Jarrett Patterson, and Jarrett Patterson knows that he's ready. Ian's ready for the ball. Snap it when you're ready. So everyone's going to react when Jarrett snapping it. There's no way for them to know for sure. Now, they could have some sort of communication where after Aaron touches him, it's got to be within 1 second or something. I don't know that for sure how they totally operate that. But the clapping thing is it's pretty simple. When Ian claps, they all know that he's going to snap the ball. And Cole Kmet was looking in and seeing Ian still clapping, and you can see Aaron Banks is still looking back at Ian because he's under the impression they're running on the silent count. And so Cole Kmet takes off because he sees Ian clapping, and then that's how you get those penalties. And I'm not sure when exactly Notre Dame realized that was an issue and why it was an issue going into the game, why they didn't anticipate that being some sort of a problem. I think there were times where Ian just flat out forgot, and that so they can we can talk about how much did Notre Dame prepare themselves for this as much as we want, but if the player forgets, I don't know. You can blame that on the coaching for not having grounded that into their brains during the week that you can't be clapping when we have a silent count and we have to make sure we're all on the same page there. But sometimes it just does come down to the players doing what they were taught to do, and I don't totally know because we weren't there of how much they reviewed this. Brian Kelly seems to have taken the blame for it, and I'd be interested to know how they thought this was going to play out versus how it actually did play out, because it was certainly a little befuddling how it seemed to not only happen once, but after that it continued to happen.
And no matter what Michigan does the weeks before they play Notre Dame October 26th, they'll have a chance to show their improvement or not,
right,
up at the Big House, because it'll be very, very loud.
And it'll be loud. It might be boos for Michigan if Notre Dame is able to take advantage of them, but it'll be loud for sure. Next and last one is from Decided Schematic Advantage from at Dome and Golder. Does Notre Dame have a glimmer of hope at ever having an atmosphere even close to what we saw Saturday night? What can that administration do realistically to encourage more passion at home games?
One thing I think would be to invite the Georgia fans to buy season tickets because they're crazy.
They are crazy.
And
they had so many pregame chants and cheers. It was like an endless tradition fest. It was unbelievable. And everyone knew what to do. It's like, okay, what you guys done yet? Here comes some guy playing a horn and another chant and telling Notre Dame to go to hell and all kinds of stuff. So it was something else. That is dedication from the fans. But I think they did a good job of they built it up to be this production, and they did some things against Notre Dame with the lights and stuff that they hadn't done in the past, and I thought were pretty neat as well.
And I think allowing live animals in the stadium might help and let them sit in the seats too. But I think they've made some strides there with the video board, with the sound system, even with the architecture of the suites, it holds the sound in better.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as long as you have people that are sitting kind of near the field that are feel like the golf clap is the signature Notre Dame cheer.
And standing isn't a requirement on big plays.
Right. That you're going to have a tempered response in Notre Dame Stadium.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess Notre Dame can try to do more of the things that Georgia does in terms of creating the atmosphere, playing more music, and they have done that. They've been doing that, and I think they're getting better at that. And I think you almost have to hope that maybe alienate some of these older fans that don't like it and feel like, okay, this isn't what I want to be a part of, and then hope that Notre Dame has people willing to pay for those seats that want to be a part of that and create an atmosphere like that. I'm curious to see if what they've seen both with Georgia coming up here and from Notre Dame having go down to Georgia inspires some sort of change within the fan base or within Notre Dame and trying to figure out how to recreate some of that, because I think you have to. And I'd be curious to ask Brian Kelly after the season if even he's like, hey, do we got to do something different here? What can we do to make it like that? Because I imagine he was probably pretty impressed by what Georgia was able to do with that atmosphere too. You couldn't miss it. It wasn't like you can totally block it out and ignore it. It doesn't matter who you were, you or how serious you were taking what you were doing. It was visibly and audibly affecting the game against Notre Dame. All right, that's it for this week's episode of Pot of Gold. If you don't already, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. Leave us a review or rating if you like what you hear. The Pot of Gold podcast is presented each week by Zaxby's, taking chicken to a whole new level of flavor. Stop by your neighborhood Zaxby's today or order at Zaxby's.com and Tire Rack, the way tire buying should be. Later this week, Tom Noy and Carter Carls will give you another edition of Pot of Gold Extra Point. Stick with NDInsider.com for plenty of Notre Dame-Virginia coverage throughout the week.